If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, March the 12th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism and your host of Area 45. My guest today on a recording studio on the emptied classroom campus that is Stanford University is John Cochran. John Cochran is the Jack and Rosemary Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research and an adjunct scholar of the Cato Institute. He's a free contributor to the Wall Street Journal, and he's the author of the Grumpy Economist blog, which he describes as, quote, news, views, and commentary from a humorous free market point of view. John, welcome back to the podcast, and I wish there were more pleasant economic times for us to have a conversation.
So do I.
So let's go to the Grumpy Economist blog and let's look at what you wrote on March the 3rd, the heading Coronavirus Monetary Policy. Let me read your words back to you. Quote, I think we need a detailed pandemic-induced financial crisis plan that forestalls bankruptcies and insolvencies where possible without causing downstream crises among people who are counting on being paid back and floods the country with money in the right spots as insurance would do, but not too many of the wrong spots. You went on to write, quote, yes, you heard it here. Judiciously targeted bailouts are really the only way I can think of to keep businesses and people from going bankrupt, given the absence of pandemic insurance. And you added, quote, we need a detailed pandemic response financial plan, sort of like an earthquake, flood, fire, or hurricane plan that local governments and FEMA routinely make that practice. So you, John Cochran, sounds like you want a stimulus.
No. Absolutely not. A stimulus, as many people are proposing now, Jason Furman said the federal government should send everybody a $1,000 check.
Ask you about that. Let's get to him in a minute.
Many people think the Fed should be stimulating. The idea of stimulus is to give people money so they'll go out and spend it.
Right.
That is completely pointless. What are you going to – giving people money to go out and spend it to get the economy going? Well, if the stores are closed,
right,
where are you going to spend it? And do we really want people to take a stimulus check and go on the round-the-world cruise, for mm-hmm. example? We are now shutting down voluntarily the economy, and I think we will soon be in an Italy situation where our government is going to be shutting it down by force.
Mm-hmm.
The name of the economic program right now is not to stimulate the economy to more output.
Mm-hmm.
Once you think this is real, which it is,
right,
the economic problem is to get us through the inevitable shutdown of the economy and make sure we can turn the economy back on again.
Mm-hmm.
That's the crucial issue, to make sure this could be 3 months, it could be 6 months,
right,
but that this doesn't turn into a long slump. Instead, it just turns into a long staycation. The economy shuts down all the time. Like,
right,
it seems like from Halloween to New Year's, nothing happens. January 2, we're ready to go. Now, so the economic challenge is to make sure we're ready to go again and haven't done a lot of damage.
I want you to define judiciously targeted bailout to me, but first let's talk a little bit more about the stimuli, John. Keynesians quickly point you to spending in World War II as a great example of how the government can pump money into the economy and great things can happen. We have had two stimuli in the last decade plus. We had a 2008 stimulus with the Bush administration, I think it was $168 billion, John. And then in February 2009, a month into his presidency, Barack Obama and Democratic Congress come up with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. What worked and did not work about those stimuli?
Well, to the extent stimulus ever works, the argument for stimulus is that your problem is lack of demand, people
mm-hmm.
not spending enough, and we need them and saving too much, and we need them to stop saving and go out and spend things. And we could spend a pleasant hour on the historical, theoretical, conceptual reasons for and against stimulus, when it might work, when it might not work. But it absolutely does not work and should not work if you're in a pandemic and either businesses are closed down because everyone wants to stay home or they're
right.
closed down because the government's telling them to stay home. And even if they wanted to reopen, they can't get supplies from China because their supply chain is shut down. This is a supply problem, if you will, not a demand problem. So if ever there was a case where stimulus is not appropriate, this is it.
Okay. In the February 2008 stimulus, the Bush administration sent $600 checks to individual tax filers, $1,200 for couples, and in addition, $300 for if you had a child in your family. This is not unlike what the aforementioned Jason Furman has proposed, Jason Furman being the former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Obama administration. He says the federal government should send a $1,000 check lickety split. To every American, John, $1,000 per person plus $500 for every kid in your household. That means that you get $1,000, I get $1,000, Michael Bloomberg gets $1,000, Bill and Melinda Gates and their three children would get $3,500, John, which would buy about 20 shares of Microsoft stock. But is there any evidence of this being good economics that I give John Cochran $1,000? What's John Cochran going to do with $1,000?
We can argue about that in some circumstances. Let's talk about that in the current circumstance. Mm-hmm. What is the purpose of this $1,000 check? If the purpose is stimulus, you want people to say, hey, honey, let's go out and buy.
Right,
right now, that's not the economic problem. The
right.
economic challenge is we need to shut things down and be ready to turn them back on again. Now, there is an argument for something like stimulus, and it is how do we get through a 3 to 6 month period where things have to get shut down? And I want to be clear. We're going to talk about the economics here and mm-hmm. those of us who are healthy. There's a whole
right.
separate public health and how do you handle people's medical problems and not the hospitals being overstuffed and so forth. That's mm-hmm. off the table. The question right now is just the economic impact. You know, giving people money to go spend now is a terrible idea. Now, what we want to do is be ready to turn the economy back on again, which means we don't want to do a lot of damage. So here's what I'm worried about. During the 3 to 6 months of off, if this had been planned the way a long vacation is planned, the way a holiday is planned, businesses would have cash set aside. People would have cash set aside. You could easily keep your life going and your business going during the shutdown. Mm-hmm. The problem is that this was unplanned. People didn't save up ahead of time for it. There was no widespread pandemic insurance payments that you could get some extra cash.
Right.
So I'm worried everyone is focusing immediately on people because I think people vote.
Yes.
But from an and they love it when you send them checks.
Yes.
But, you know, Chuck Schumer said, we don't want to give the money to corporations. Well, I hate to tell Chuck, where the problem is businesses, because businesses are highly leveraged. If you're running a restaurant, an airline, a cruise ship, a store, anything, nothing's going to be coming in the front door for a couple of months.
Right.
And you still have to pay your rent. You still have to pay your mortgage. You still have to pay your debts. You still hopefully have to pay your employees, their salary, their sick leave, their furloughs, their benefits, I hope. We don't want businesses firing employees, cutting them off their benefits right now, their health plans right now in the middle of it. So you want the businesses to be keeping the money. But businesses are much tighter. They have much less cash hanging around than most people.
Right.
So I think really that the danger here is that in a undetermined long shutdown, a lot of businesses fail. They don't pay their debts, or the financial system, if they can't get money out of businesses and the businesses fail, then the banks are in trouble once again. You can see the financial chaos spreading right now. The treasury markets are going nuts. The stock markets are going nuts. There is a danger of this shutdown turning into another financial crisis. So mm-hmm. keeping the businesses alive so that they're ready to turn back on again
right.
strikes me as the most important thing. Now, keeping people alive is important, too. People who don't have, many people have savings. And, you know, it's funny. They just say, oh, go work from home. Well, there's a lot of people who don't just work on computers and they can't go work at home. There's a lot of people who don't make, if they don't work, they don't make any money and who have no savings.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been nice if they had savings ahead of time, but they don't. Help, it is, I'm getting around to Furman, helping people who don't have savings keep the minimum going, pay their rent, utilities, have enough food, and, you know, get through a 3 to 6 month time off as if it were a vacation. That is important.
Right.
But that's a matter of empathy and helping our fellow citizens. Keeping our businesses, even if they're corporations, going is vital to having this be a V-shaped recovery, to getting the economy going again. So just flipping the light switch back on and not the virus is over, your businesses, they've fired all their employees, they're shut down, they've defaulted on their loans, the banks are in deep trouble. That's the worry right now.
Right. So would you, John Cochran, would you give money to Disney? Disney, for example, which is probably going to have a very bad time running Disney World and Disneyland. Disney, which may suffer by people not wanting to go to the theater to look at movies. Disney, which relies upon the generosity of people willing to gather in crowds.
Yeah, I want to walk back some of that bailout because I've been thinking about it harder. I think what I'm in favor of now is less just money. Uh-huh. I mean, the $1,000 checks, like you said, they go to me and you. Frankly, I got enough to last 6 months. I don't need the $1,000. I think the right approach, you want to get money to where it's needed.
Right.
And I think the central problem is going to be in the credit markets. You're running a restaurant, a Disneyland. You say, mm-hmm. Oh, my God, we got to get through 6 months here. I got to keep paying my employees and my bills. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the bank and see if they'll give me a bridge loan.
Right.
The bank, of course, laughs at you because you got no income coming in. They're not going to give you a loan. Whether the Fed has lowered the interest rate 1% or 2%, that doesn't matter. And if they wanted to give you a loan, their regulators would scream at you if they gave you a
right.
loan. I think, and this is a standard thing we do after floods and other emergencies, really helping businesses to borrow with some subsidized lending. You want to kind of synthesize what would have been a pandemic insurance contract. You pay a premium and you get some money in bad times. So by making it borrowing that you have to pay back as opposed to just a gift, then you get people to sign up who really need it, and then you can get more money where it's really needed mm-hmm. and less money where it isn't, which as long as you think that government money doesn't just grow on trees, which some people do these days, being efficient about where the money goes, I think is important. So I would favor lots of help on lending. There's also, boy, it would be nice if we thought about this ahead of time. Plans to just kind of slow things down. Banks should forbear loans. If you're not able to pay, mm-hmm. the bank says, okay, you know, we're not going to send you into bankruptcy court and seize assets because of that. But, of course, now the bank has to pay its bills.
Right.
So just kind of slowing things down is a natural response to an emergency like this. But that, too, has to be thought through.
All right, John, let's talk about the judiciously targeted bailout, because it seems to me the immediate challenge here is that Washington is getting to work on what to do. And Washington's a sausage factory. You may want to do something targeted, but the fact of the matter is they're going to produce a very big sausage link for the American people. It's going to be political as much as economics. And so money to people, things which maybe economically don't make sense. Let's walk through a few things that the president talked about last night, a few things that the Democrats in Congress want to do, John, and then let's get your idea on what the right solution is. So the president goes on the airwaves last night, and he talks about how to deal with the crisis. He, first of all, authorizes the Small Business Administration to issue $50 billion and loans to compensate businesses whose income is impacted by efforts to respond to the coronavirus outbreak. This is funding subject to congressional approval. He uses emergency authority instructing the Treasury Department to defer tax payments without interest or penalties for certain individuals and businesses negatively impacted. The president claims this action will provide more than $200 billion of additional liquidity to the economy, John. And then Trump called for, in his words, quote, immediate payroll tax relief, immediate payroll tax relief. He didn't offer a figure. He was on Capitol Hill the day before he gave a speech where he reportedly floated the idea of a 0% payroll tax for the rest of the year, but we don't know exactly what the president's going to put forward. So that's what the president is talking about, John. Now on the Democratic side, what do you have? Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer reportedly are in favor of paid sick leave. President said he's on board with that, too, so let's assume that goes into the sausage. They want expanded unemployment assistance benefits for natural disasters. They want protection against price gouging, all of which is legislation may be headed to the president's desk sometime soon. So you've heard these thoughts, John. Does any of this sound like sound economics to you? I'm especially interested in the payroll tax.
As you prefaced it, a lot of this is politics.
Yes.
A lot of this is trying to sneak in things we've always wanted. The answer is always the same. The questions just change. You know, mm-hmm. paid sick leave, they've been wanting it for 20 years.
Right.
Now we need it because of the coronavirus. But I will, the problem they're facing is the catastrophic fault of both parties is that we have no plan here, mm-hmm. Which is the thing I am most astonished to learn. The fact that CEA chairs are telling you we need stimulus tells you, well, you know, CEA chairs have seen all the plans. That means there is no pandemic economic plan. I looked it up in about 2005. The Bush administration said, hey, you know, we need sort of a plan in case one of these comes. They put up a nice glossy report. It was full of great things that we should do, and then it sat there on the shelf.
Right.
As another indication of no plan, is, you know, our central banks have been running stress tests for a long time, and bank regulators, and to the extent the international ones, the Financial Stability Board, Bank of International Settlements, the IMF, they now want climate and inequality risks to be part of the stress tests. Mm-hmm. No one put pandemic anywhere in these stress tests. The Fed, the regulatory agents, the idea that we that the next financial crisis might be sparked from a stress from a pandemic, is one that apparently never occurred to anybody, which tells you something about the whole project. We are woefully unprepared, and this matters. The sort of lesson one of political science is you can't ask a bureaucracy to invent something on the fly.
Right.
If listeners have ever read Graham Allison's masterful account of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's the lesson.
Yes.
Don't ask them to make things up. So the problem they're facing here is there are things that could be done and should be done. Detailed bank regulation rules on how you handle loans during an event like a pandemic, those needed to be done. Rules on, our social programs say you can get unemployment insurance if you're actually unemployed for good reasons. We don't want money to be handed out and subsidize people not working. Well, you kind of need an escape clause for pandemic, mm-hmm. but it so that you can get help when you're furloughed but not really unemployed. But writing all those rules, implementing them, letting the field office in San Francisco know they're in place, you can't do that in real time. I'm getting around to answering your question, but the fundamental problem is we're trying to scramble at the last moment.
Right.
And even though we have terrorism plans, nuclear war plans, stress tests that go even down to the level of climate change risks, there is just our government, both parties, both administrations, nobody sat down to write what's the economic plan for pandemic.
Right. Now, be careful. This is how you're going to end up with a pandemic czar.
Oh, that might not be the worst thing in the world.
If he or she is tasked to doing preparedness things.
We have a financial stability board, and we mm-hmm. have a whole thing ready to replay 2007.
Right.
Czars, a organization after this is all over that thinks, because the next one is coming. Sooner or later, I'm going to answer your question, by the way, but the next one, this is actually not bad.
Right.
Out there is sitting a one that is more infectious than this and kills 20% of the people and shuts down the entire economy for a year, and I mean totally shuts down. That's out there. The possibility of, I wrote a recent blog post, bioterrorists could engineer something very cheaply that's way worse than this and shuts down the economy. So nobody's worried about this, but that is one of the biggest risks we face, and we need a plan. Okay, now, we don't have a plan. What do we do?
What do we do?
We don't have a plan. Yeah, you got to try to get enough money to the right places so that people aren't horribly hurt, the sort of the insurance function of government, and so that businesses are still alive and ready to go when it's time to go up. That's why I liked the idea of lending, possibly somewhat subsidized lending. It has to be because we know where they're going to get the money to pick you back. Some way of finding out from people how badly do you need it. Oh, boy, you gave me a whole list of other ideas. I don't know if we're going to have time to comment on each one of them. I advocated, actually, rather than postponing taxes is an idea. Postponing, not you never have to pay them.
Right.
That gives you a little bit of cash. Being able to borrow against your future taxes seemed to me like a clever idea.
Interesting.
Why don't you call up the IRS and say, give me 10 grand? Because the IRS is very good at collecting if it puts its mind to it.
Right.
It's not obvious in our democracy that we actually collect on loans like student debts that are supposed to be collected that way, but at least that's a possibility. A lot of the other, we don't want to create new entitlements that last forever. We want to create ways of getting, the ways that our current bureaucracy can get money to places to keep it alive so it's ready to turn on again. So yeah, small business loans, mm-hmm. that sounds like a useful one if it's quick.
Yes.
And if it's not structured, of course, the longer this goes on, the more the chance of, hey, you and I, let's go get a small business loan. I need about $100,000 to keep the keep your podcast going, and then we'll be off in Mexico when it's over. The problem of making this up, as we go along, is it's very open abuse. So, with all of that preamble and large picture? Are there specific ones of these things? I wrote them down, but that you'd like me to comment on, good or bad, from both sides? Give me sort of one from each side that you think is most important to comment on.
Well, immediate payroll tax relief. Because this is the president keeps talking about it. There's political sexiness to it because you have the words payroll and tax relief in it, or tax cut. But is this good economics to do
so this? So is relief temporary or permanent? I mean,
we don't know. We don't know. This is the TBA, to be announced.
This is the problem that in all these things, we use the passive voice. I noticed you said paid sick leave but didn't say by who.
Yes, right.
Immediate tax, if tax relief means you never have to pay those taxes, well, we do have this problem that Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are
financed by the payroll tax, right?
And the criticism is I think, somewhat correct. Payroll tax relief helps people who still have jobs. Mm-hmm. And the ones I'm worried about are the ones who, you know, your Uber driver who is got nothing from now until people start traveling again. So I would rate that as... You can see the advantage that's something you can do quickly without rewriting all the rules. Mm-hmm. You can see the disadvantage. It doesn't really target money in a place that keeps the economic infrastructure alive and ready to turn back on again, or people who are going to be having really hard times taking the staycation that you and I are going to enjoy because we have a lot of savings.
Right.
You said paid sick leave.
Yes, paid sick leave.
I think I get the sense this is forcing employers to pay employees if they want to take time off.
Correct.
Which is lovely, except the government always, a bankrupt government always jumps to, I'm going to tell A to pay B something rather than I'm going to pay for it. Well, the problem is A is in trouble too. So if companies, you want companies to keep paying their workers, even though the workers aren't working, so the workers can you know, sit at home for a while.
Right.
But if the companies go bankrupt because they can't afford to pay the workers, then we have a double problem. The workers don't have that money. And when you're ready to turn the economy on again, the business is boarded up. Mm-hmm. So if the government's going to pay sick leave, we can talk about it, if that a useful use of the money. If you're forcing companies to pay sick leave, there's this vision that companies just sit on pots of cash. I got news for you. So companies sit on pots of debts, and right. they manage their cash very closely. And few companies have the resources to go on for months with nothing coming in the front door.
Right. And then let's talk about price gouging, John. Kind of hidden in that list. Protection against price gouging. In other words, we're going to turn the federal government loose on the market and determine what is price gouging.
A terrible idea. It is interesting how this happens after every emergency. After a hurricane, they say gas stations aren't allowed to charge more for gas. The result is you can't get any gas.
Right.
And if you're having a heart attack and you need to get your kid to the hospital, or you need to get to the hospital, you can't get any gas. The larger category of economic mistake that it is it's trying to transfer incomes by interfering with prices. Especially, you know, a gallon of gas isn't going to break anybody in the big scheme of things. It might mm-hmm. be hard to come up with $50, which will be $200 after a hurricane, but a gallon of gas isn't the end of the world. Whereas the important thing is for you and I not to go gas up our cars after a hurricane and to get it to the people who need it the most, the fire, the police, the ambulances, the people having heart attacks.
Right.
Resources need to go to their highest use. Don't try to equalize incomes by screwing with the price of things, especially with a shortage. The other problem as it does is it stops the supply. If you don't let the price of gas go up after a hurricane, no one has the incentive to bring the gas in. Same with, you know, masks. If you keep down the price of masks, then people who really need them can't get them, and there's no incentive to go get a truckload worth of masks down in Fresno and drive them into where they're needed.
Right.
So I think that's an instinct we have after every emergency, and a horrible one.
Let's talk, John, about economic confidence in this regard. I was watching the futures market while the president spoke last night, and bless you. And while the president spoke, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 1,100 points, John, about 4.74% in pre-market trading. NASDAQ was down about 400 points or 5%. The market opened today. Wall Street stopped trading about 15 minutes in, put it to a halt. The last I checked, the market was down about 1,700 points. Explain what is going on here as an economist would see it. We have these terms that we use, panic, crisis, fear runs things like this. Explain the mindset that's going on here with the financial markets and how a president economically can get a hold of this and try to turn things around. Because I assume that's what Trump was trying to do in part last night. He's trying to tell the markets that all is well, and clearly the markets don't respond to that.
Well, so stock markets have to price in their best guess of what's going to happen.
Right. You always hear the cliche, markets operate on certainty.
Well, they are trying to guess right. How bad is the economic damage going to be. And not just 6 months of lost profits because we shut down, you know, we turned into Italy for 6 months. Mm-hmm. But what is the chance of the nightmare scenarios I've been outlining that after the end of it, half the businesses in the country are going bankrupt? I don't know how Boeing's going to get through this. I don't know how United Airlines is going to get through this. How's right. Disney? Well, Disney has all sorts of other properties, but and that's just the big ones. So they're pricing in not just 6 months of lost profits. They're pricing in a inadequate shut down the economy and turn it back on response, and mm-hmm. that then this turns into a financial crisis mm-hmm. and a long recession. I think that's a possibility. What you're seeing in the market, I would call it volatility more than a direction. Mm-hmm. The markets just don't know what's going to happen because none right. of us knows what's going to happen. So there's lots of up and downs. We're also seeing a scramble for cash. Treasury, there's bid-ask spreads are widening. Treasury markets are having trouble. Credit spreads are widening. Why? Well, because we all need cash. You know, if you're going to weather 3 to 6 months of nothing happening, mm-hmm. you need cash. And a scramble for cash is what leads to a financial crisis. We, I think, are on the edges of this turning into the classic scramble for cash kind of financial crisis. That would lead the economic problems to be much worse, much longer lasting. And so, there's good reasons why we are looking at the kinds of markets we were looking at in the summer of 2007. Is that going to happen or not? I don't think so, but it's certainly a possibility.
Now, you were careful not to use the term financial crisis. You do not see this as a crisis right now?
Not right now, no. A financial crisis is a run on short-term debt. Mm-hmm. Beginning, ending, stop.
Okay.
We are not yet having a run on short-term debt, but we could soon. Because as for the moment, nobody's worried about financial institutions going bankrupt. You see the chance of, maybe they'll run out. They've over-leveraged. Jimmy Stewart, I go get my money out before you can get your money out. That right. is a financial crisis. And we should be clear about it. A decline in the stock market, like we had in the tech bust, that's not a crisis. That's just you lost a lot of money.
Yes.
But a crisis is where credit markets seize up because there's a run. So far, as far as I can tell, that isn't happening, but that is the event we, and I hope to goodness, our financial supervisors, who were all around last time, although they didn't put this in their stress tests, nonetheless, I think they're attuned to the possibility. And I'm certainly hearing sort of rumors from the bowels of the Fed, stuff you don't read about in the newspapers, that they're working hard on the regulatory aspect, on encouraging banks not to cut off people who aren't paying back their loans, but encouraging banks, they won't shut the banks down if they do that sort of thing, so it won't turn into a financial crisis. But I think that's what markets are worried. There's a reason the Dow's down. If I just told you we're all going to take a 3 to 6 months vacation mm-hmm. and then the economy will come right back, the markets wouldn't be down anywhere near this much.
Because they say 6 months from now, things will be better.
Yes. Well, and things should be better. If you can just turn the economy right back on as if we had a double Halloween to New Year's period in the economy, mm-hmm. Then no reason not to be right back where we are. So long as all the businesses, banks, financial institutions, airlines, hotels are still in business, ready to call their employees and say, come back, time to go to work.
As far as I know, John Cochrane, you are not a financial advisor. You do not tell people where to park their money. But let's say Jason Furman got his way. And let's say that you and I each got a couple thousand dollars out of this. And we wanted to invest the money. Where would you park the money?
Well, of course, Jason wants us to spend it.
Well, right? He wants to spend it. He wants
the
it
whole
to go.
The whole yeah. point of stimulus is we don't save it, we spend it.
Right, but getting back to your Mexico already. Scenario, we're going to do what we want to do with the money. So let's say instead of going to Mexico and having a grand old time, we decide we want to invest it.
So investment advice remains the same as it always is. If you know, if you think you know better than everybody else, then buy and sell actively. Beware that everybody else thinks they know better than you, and half of you are wrong by definition. Otherwise, you know, I follow a passive investing strategy and don't try to time things. If you're going to bail out of the market because you're worried about it going down, make darn sure you will have the courage to bail back in again when you think it's the bottom. And that's always the difficult part of market timing strategies.
Right, but do you put your money into bonds? Do you look for some other security to tie your money into that's not Wall Street?
There's risk and return. The more risk, you know, society pays you for bearing risk. Somebody has to hold the stocks. Somebody has to hold the junk bonds.
Right.
Now, we seem to be heading into a period where society will pay you more for bearing that risk. The second message is take risks that you can afford to bear. And there's everything from the bars of gold, cans of beans, and guns investment strategy, which has a very low average return but is very very good in certain kinds of risks, to, you know, jumping into the markets, getting ready to buy in the dips, actively trading on the head of the next rumor. Good luck to you.
Right. Did you take any psychology courses during the path of your academic studying?
I have not taken formal education in psychology.
Well, I think this crisis for an economist maybe involves a little psychological understanding, because there is a word out there, and the word is fear. We encountered fear after 9/11 in terms of people afraid to get on airplanes. And we got over that after a certain period of time. We had fear at the financial crisis of 2008. People got over it after a certain period of time. We had fear in the Great Depression, John, which manifested in all sorts of ways. People not just losing their livelihoods, families falling apart, just societal craziness. But we're in another phase of fear right now. And it's not just the fear of how your stocks are doing. It's the fear of stepping outside and getting sick, the fear of not knowing if the government's in charge of the situation. Economically, how does the United States of America get over fear?
Ah, good. I'm glad you made that clearer than challenging my lack of wide enough education.
No, Franklin Roosevelt said famously, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. But fear is not to be discounted here, because there are very legitimate reasons to be afraid of what's going on.
It turned out the only thing we had to fear was Franklin Roosevelt.
Yes, pumping a lot of money into the economy. That's another story for another day.
We'll do let's sit down some other day and do how Roosevelt made the Great Depression worse. To an economist, fear is the subjective perception of marginal products and marginal utility, so I'm happy to talk about fear. Your comments seem to view the idea that this was an irrational fear, that somehow we're smart and the rest of them are behavioral and jumping too
hard. No, not that, John, but it's just people are genuinely afraid. And part of you know, controlling the horse, getting the horse back on course, is convincing the horse not to be afraid. The horse is spooked right now.
Right. Well, I think the horse ought to be spooked. In fact, the problem governments face in managing a pandemic is usually that people are not fearful enough.
Yes.
There is a classic, this is a case, I'm a great libertarian, but this is a case, managing pandemics is a case for forceful government action, because there is the mother of all externalities here. You might think, oh, I'll just go into work, I'm only have a sneeze or a cough, and the result of that action could be 1,000 people die.
Right.
Governments have to force you to stay home. Usually, the problem is not getting people to fear things enough. Our governments usually have this problem. They're behavioral too, let's not forget that. Just as prone to psychology. The usual government response, as China did, is to minimize it in the initial stages, because you don't want people to panic exactly when it would be most useful for everyone to panic. If we could have, a month ago, shut down the economy for 3 weeks, everyone go stay home for 3 weeks, then we had enough test kits, which is a crime that we don't, test absolutely everybody who's sick at the end of 3 weeks and isolate them, this would be over now. So I'm not sure that the point of a government right now should be just to tell people not to worry.
Right.
They tried that. The point is to have the right kind of fear to get people to behave right now. You don't want just massive irrational fear. You want you want people to understand the probabilities, the kinds of actions that are dangerous to themselves and to others. We got to keep as much of the economy going as we can. We certainly, you know, you need to get the hospitals, the grocery stores, the ambulances, you know, as much as going as you can. I mean, so you don't want total fear to overcome things. I'm not that great a believer in our federal government as psychologist in chief, whose ability to decide our emotional state and massage us is something we should particularly put great faith in. Let's just get competent public health, competent financial management, and getting us through an economic crisis, and the rest will take care of it.
Right, but politically, we do now in this modern age expect the President of the United States to be at times a consoler-in-chief. A natural tragedy occurs, the President goes on TV and says, all will be well. Ronald Reagan gave me the Challenger speech, Bill Clinton gave me the Oklahoma City speech, and that was part of last night's challenge for Donald Trump to go on television and tell people things are going to get better. And I would just say by the market's response to it, he didn't do a very good job.
Well, he
now part of the challenge, John, might be it's Donald Trump, and this is just not what Donald Trump can do.
This is a golden opportunity for Donald Trump or for any politician.
How so?
Because nobody became famous for stopping something in its tracks ahead of time, but presidents get famous for their handling of wars and national emergencies.
Right.
So this is the moment for President Trump or any politician to display calm and effective leadership in times of crisis. This, you know, I made fun of Roosevelt for making the Great Depression worse, mm-hmm. but Roosevelt handled it politically beautifully. He convinced everybody that he was in charge and doing stuff and mm-hmm. was going to shepherd us through this great national tragedy.
Right.
So, the movie Wag the Dog.
Yes.
Presidents are often tempted to cause fake national emergencies in order to display their leadership and unite their population, both to be the great consolers-in-chief, the great planner-in-chief, the great we need to all get together and solve this. This is how you get famous as a president. Mm-hmm. This is a golden opportunity for Mr. Trump and his advisors, and I'm only saying something political, which I usually don't, to encourage, because it'd also be good for the country if they did it. But if you can just look presidential, whew, you'll be screaming through the elections in November.
Well, there could actually be a benefit here. If politicians are afraid of large crowds, we'll have fewer campaign rallies in 2020. Maybe not such a bad thing. We could kind of take a time out from the partisan politics and work on problems. But I'm curious about this in this respect, John.
Well, can I just...
yeah, go ahead.
Your mention of campaign rallies is the danger. I do worry, maybe not this pandemic. Mm-hmm. When I think of what could bring down America... in our frayed political system, our ability to handle a serious pandemic is one. I mean, imagine a pandemic where 10 or 20% of people are dying. And imagine it happens in the fall and President Trump says, we have to cancel political rallies mm-hmm. because it's dangerous to the nation. Do you think with a tight election looming, the Democrats are going to go along with we have to cancel political rallies because it's dangerous to the nation? And you have to trust in a time of emergency, in our democracy, a time of emergency is a time when the government takes on powers that it normally does not are not allowed. Powers to tell you where to go and when to go. Powers to tell you not to assemble. I mean, it's in the Constitution, freedom of assembly. Sorry, that's banned for a moment. You need that trust that this is a time of crisis and that this will all pass afterwards. Mm-hmm. Do we have that trust? Do the both parties have that trust that taking on the kinds of powers that our government is normally not allowed to take on temporarily in time of crisis, that can happen? I'm worried it all just falls apart.
So what comes to mind is John McCain suspending his campaign in 2008, John, during the financial crisis, saying, I need to be in Washington and I want to be at the White House being part of the deal being done, and this is another time for politics. I need to be doing my day job. And he got hammered within Republican circles for doing this, people saying, my God, what are you thinking? You're running for office. You can't stop campaigning.
Yeah, and let's suppose President Trump says, you know what, we've seen where the virus is really strongest in San Francisco, so we have to stop public assemblies in San Francisco. Is Nancy Pelosi going to go along with that one? Oh, yes, I think that's a sober assessment of the public health risks.
Yeah.
The whole thing, if you don't have that trust that the government can temporarily suspend all sorts of civil liberties, boy, are you in trouble.
Right. So this is the other interesting aspect of coronavirus, John, and that, especially from a California standpoint. We live in California, which is in many regards a Really? Decadent society. We enjoy the good life. We enjoy good food. We enjoy good wine. And we enjoy a lot of creature comforts. And what you see is that creature comforts are systematically being taken away from California's Coachella. I don't know if you go to Coachella every year. It has been postponed. Well, it has been killed. It's postponed until October. Golden State Warriors basketball, the NBA now, the Lakers, the Warriors, the Clippers, very good basketball teams. It's been suspended. People's lifestyles, how people enjoy their lives, is being changed by this virus. I'm just kind of curious your thoughts on how the public reacts to this, because, again, in past crises, have people's, you know, creature comforts been taken away from them like this?
Well, for the moment, not just creature comforts, but economic livelihood.
Yes.
Right now, I think this is playing well. People understand, look, this is a necessary thing. Mm-hmm. I'm really impressed with Stanford's response, closing down classes, canceling conferences and meetings. So now kind of the response is, oh, yeah, this is a temporary inconvenience. But as this goes on for 3 months, as we turn into Italy and stay there for a while, I think the inevitable thing is people get tired of it. Mm-hmm. They want to go back to work. They understand that their own personal risk is small, but they're being told no because of the externality risk. So right now, since public fear is ahead of institutional intervention, people are going along with it. But after 2 months of sitting at home, I think that is going to turn around, and then it's going to be really hard. Then people are really going to start complaining about virus, especially. So what's going to happen is the virus is still on the exponential upward trend.
Right.
You put in, as China did, you know, Italy, everybody go nowhere. The virus starts to peter out. It's sort of like antibiotics. If you know, you're tempted not to do the full 2 week course because you feel better after 2 days.
Exactly.
The virus will start to peter out, new cases start to peter out, and then everyone says, okay, well, time to get going again because I had those tickets to the concert and and the airline isn't giving me back my refund and it's time to go to Hawaii or whatever. And then if you slack off, then the whole thing just starts up all over again. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger is actually this fall. What I gather is medically, viruses tend to, on their own, during the summer, they tend to fall down and then come back again in the fall, just as everyone has kind of gotten tired of listening to the government and voluntarily. How long are people going to self-quarantine?
Right.
That people are going to escape by October, November. People are going to get mighty sick of that. And so there's actually a big danger for next winter.
Final question, John. We've talked about industries being in distress, like airlines, for example. What about the health industry and what about the biotech industry right now? What, if anything, can the government can be doing to push the biotech industry along to find the cure? I've seen people just flippantly throw out, well, offer a $50 billion prize for the first person gets a cure or something like that. But are there any incentives the federal government can do to help research move faster?
You mentioned industries at the outset. I meant to say that the project of the federal government picking which industries are in distress and sending
yes.
them boatloads of cash is probably a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to let industries and businesses figure that out on their own. So offer the same kinds of loans you can get through this to anyone, and those who need it more can take it more. The government has been distressingly incompetent at handling the public health. I mean, why are there no test kits?
Right.
Why did the FDA forbid the use of test kits? Why were hospitals not allowed to use private test kits? As in the usual libertarian way, I first look for could we get the hell out of the way
mm-hmm.
before how does the federal government come up with some new project to push?
Right.
Which means figuring out why are the incentives not there. I gather researchers are doing a tremendous job. Stuff's being discovered, published quickly. The main threat facing a pharmaceutical company, if you came up with a virus, coronavirus vaccine or cure, what is the chance that you will be allowed to charge a competitive price for this thing?
Right.
The natural way one does such things is you call up all the billionaires in Palo Alto and say, you can have it first, $10 million a piece. That pays back a lot of your incentives. And then you run down the curve and 2 weeks later, everyone's got it. Do you think there's a chance in heck that that a coronavirus vaccine, that a company would be allowed to profit from a coronavirus vaccine? Probably not.
Right.
To say nothing of the difficulties of, are you going to have to do 3-stage clinical trials of safety and efficacy? The government will be paralyzed because, of course, if they say go and do it and it has side effects, then, oh, you screwed up for the side effects. So I would look, my number one question, and I'm not an expert on how these medical things work, but my impression is that getting the heck out of the way, both with regulation and for the medical stuff would be helpful. Hospitals are going to be, it's going to be a problem because there's a limited capacity. We don't,
right.
The same way I've noticed snowstorms are much worse in the South than they are in the North. The reason being that they happen so seldom that the South doesn't buy snowplows. We don't have enough ventilators for 2% of the population. Why? Because
right.
You don't need them most of the time. I gather Italy, by the way, just bought 1,000 used ventilators from China. Very clever repurposing of international assets. the hospitals are going to be overwhelmed. I don't have any big hints on that one, but it is something that people need to think about ahead of time.
Actually, the worst place to be for a snowstorm, John, is Washington, D.C.
I had that in mind. I have been
yes,
there.
Because
they have no salt, no snowplows.
No salt, no snowplows. And get back to the idea of panic and herd mentality.
Ah.
It's the threat of snow that drives people crazy. And you go to the grocery store and you stand in a long line. And you know the two commodities people buy, John? They buy milk and 12 packs of toilet paper. I understand a couple of jugs of milk to get you through the next few days. But what you're going to do with 12 rolls of toilet paper? I mean, this is not seven brides for seven brothers. How long are you going to be snowed in?
Yes, and 2 inches of snow brings D.C. to a standstill.
Right, but that's the panic mentality that we get into in terms of situations.
And they may have a reason, because since the city doesn't have any snowplows or salt, 2 inches of snow could actually shut down D.C. for a week or two.
Okay, final question, and we will conclude this conversation. The president likes to say that this economy is in a good position right now to handle this crisis. True or false? And he compares that to diverse other economies around the world, but he wants to talk up the strength of the United States economy.
The economy was very strong.
Was.
The economy's supply side fundamentals are excellent.
Mm-hmm.
This could properly manage, just be a little vacation. The numbers will be terrible for the next couple months because all sorts of things are not happening.
Actually, let's explain that, John, in terms of indices. Everybody wants to go look at the Dow. They want to look at the NASDAQ. But as an economist, what indices are you looking at?
I'm just thinking of, what was the job growth, unemployment mm-hmm. rates? Mm-hmm. We were humming along.
Right.
We understand the shock. There's no sudden exogenous lack of demand or, something mysterious going on.
Mm-hmm.
We have a pandemic. We need to shut everything down for a couple months and then turn it back on.
Right.
If we can turn it back on like we do after Christmas, it's a nothing burger and we're back to normal. But if the intervening couple of months are horribly mismanaged and lots of businesses are a fail in the meantime, if this turns into a financial crisis, then we are in serious problems. So I think we have good economic fundamentals, but I must, this administration and the last one and the last one before and the Federal Reserve and the IMF and everybody else, nobody had a pandemic plan going. And that, I think, puts us, we're making it up on the fly that Congress and the president are trading barbs about who gets what kind of innovative idea to a program. Come on, guys. Mm-hmm. That should be in the break glass in case of pandemic plan. And I think the absence of that plan, you asked, is the economy well positioned to handle it? Fundamentals, yes, but plan for getting through the problem just completely absent. And so now we're up to, can our public officials and our united, happy, bipartisan government get together to do right things, to make it up on the fly to get going? Good luck to us.
This sounds like a good conference for Hoover or Stanford to have, the question of pandemic preparation moving forward.
That would be a great conference, probably virtual in the meantime.
And maybe if we're lucky, people will actually be able to fly out here and attend it.
Yes.
John Cochran, I enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. You can get to us through Podbeam, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, the list goes on. You can also sign up for our podcast at the hoover.org website. And if you would mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of John Cochran and his colleagues your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover INST. John Cochran, brave man that he is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at John H. Cochran. That's H as in hotel. Cochran spelled C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E. John H. Cochran. And the Grumpy Economist blog, the address for that is johnhcochran.blogspot.com. Anything else I need to sell for you while we're here?
No, thanks.
Okay. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Till then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.